John, what do you see as the future of the public schools?
The future of the public schools. My concern, above all, with the public schools is that I am moderately convinced that this description of an ever more discombobulated economy, an age of creation intensification, to steal the words from our friend at Nomura Securities, are confronting us. I certainly acknowledge that we can do a lot better job on the three R's than we are now doing. But what mostly concerns me is that our school system, I believe that our school system is one of the most efficient institutions in the world. We take fabulously exciting young men or women, age four, put them into the school system, and 20 years later, they're the most boring people on earth. Now, if it works so consistently, you can't argue that it's an ineffective system. We screw almost all of them up. Look, I'm a lover. I believe that education is the key to moving forward, moving up, etc. And yet, as much as I believe it, I remain stunned at the evidence that says the large number of people, particularly who tend to succeed as entrepreneurs, were blessed by virtually a total absence of formal education. The real estate man down in Texas, Trammell Crow, once said to me, I don't have much education in a formal way. He said, you could say I was lucky enough to be untrammeled. And I thought it was a lovely line. I am not an expert on the school system. I will tell you a few of the things that bother me. Let us hope and let us pray that perhaps well-intended task forces that seem to emerge from time to time do not succeed in getting the Americans to copy the Japanese system at precisely the time that the Japanese system or Japanese are finding that it's the wrong system to have. The Japanese kids are the world's masters of memorization in an era where memorization is precisely the wrong direction in which to go. We're trying to copy the Japanese as the Japanese get fed up with their system. The others we want to copy is the German apprenticeship system. There is a hell of a lot to say for the German apprenticeship system, but my experience and research in Germany says the Germans are worried desperately about the German apprenticeship system because it does a fabulous job of training people from 1890, but the Germans just figured out in their own conservative way that it's not 1890 anymore. The other thing that bothers me, and I understand the appeal, and I guess I wish that our scores on international comparison tests were higher, but I just can't think of anything dumber than standardized tests for the country as a whole. I mean, that's really sick as far as I'm concerned. It is a time for wild experimentation in the educational system as much as, you know, I acknowledge I spent most of my adult life down south in the deep south, Page Mill Road area. And I just desperately emotionally love Silicon Valley, you know? And honest to God, it is the most screwed up place on earth. There is not a standard for any damn thing in Silicon Valley. And the magic of Silicon Valley is the most disobedient 1,300 square miles on the face of the planet Earth. It is a wonderfully, Silicon Valley is why I fell in love with Hayek when I came to Hayek late in life. The mess is the message in Silicon Valley. The failures are the message in Silicon Valley. The experimentation is the message in Silicon Valley. There's a hell of a lot we can do with our schools. My major concern is that we not apply precisely the wrong solution at a time that we're desperately concerned. I'm scared about uniformity in testing. I'm scared about copying the Japanese. I'm scared about copying the Germans. I don't know what the hell sometimes the problems with Americans are. We are trying to copy the Japanese in everything we do at precisely the time the Japanese are trying to copy us in everything that we do. truth of the matter is there's a hell of a lot to learn from the best Japanese, just like there's a hell of a lot to learn from the best of everybody. We have picked up many a trick and more than a trick from the Japanese in the last 15 years. But as to copying the system, insane indeed. I share David's concern that the love affair with the Japanese organizational model of industry and the Japanese model of everything seems to have gained sway in the last year and a half in Washington. Yes, sir.
What do you think about Silicon Valley getting $1 billion from the federal government for developing plastic displays?
Well, when I'm opposed to the consortia. I'm opposed to those projects. The good news is in the real world that it's a drop in the bucket and not enough money to screw things up. I mean, I've yelled about Semitech, and I testified back in Congress against that damn production consortium, whatever it was called, for semiconductors, and screamed and shouted, and I believe that I ought to scream and shout because I think it's an awful thing. But back in the other half of my head, I thought the good news is there's not a damn thing that's going to happen, so it's not very important. Well, I've got this funny view. It's not very ideological. It's just sort of idiosyncratic. I think other than our entrepreneurial spirit in our financial markets as well as amongst our people as a whole, the single asset as we move toward this age of more information and creativity that the Americans have that has the largest lead over the rest of the world is our higher education system. There just ain't nobody nowhere that can match the Cals, that can match the MITs, that can match the Caltechs, that can match the Stanfords. The proof of the pudding is you look at the number of people from outside the United States who come to get their PhDs in the United States. Something's going on there. The wonderful news is that most of them fall in love with the half wonderful news. The selfishly wonderful news is that half of them fall in love with the United States and never go home, which is great for us. It's rather a tragedy in part for those countries which could use that brain power. I think that universities are hopelessly screwed up, very hierarchical systems, except of course they aren't. Because you see, there's a funny little thing. There are a lot of us who at some level ideologically are opposed to tenure. And I don't like the idea of tenure at face value. The other side of the coin is that if you got a system of tenure, it means that a faculty of 1,200 people consists of 1,200 people who have no reason whatsoever to listen to the president of the institution. When he was president of Stanford, Don Kennedy used to give a speech, and among the things that he mentioned in that speech is that there's something like 73 institutions which have been consistently in existence for more than 1,000 years. One of them is the Catholic Church, one of them is the government of Iceland, and the other 71 are universities. And my suspicion is that in a funny way, the university with its islands of tenure is actually a surprisingly entrepreneurial environment, i.e. the administration can't screw with you, which to me is always a good idea in any particular institution. There are a million things universities could do better. My net take on it is universities, our research universities in particular, rank right at the top of the list or near the top of the list of the most valuable assets that the United States of America has. It troubles me greatly when I see those institutions not getting the support which I think they ought to get. They are gems indeed. Can you imagine the economy of this area without UCSF, Cal, Stanford, San Jose State, SF State, USF? It's unimaginable. It's literally unimaginable, at least it is in my mind. If we left the whole damn thing to them, we would be in a sorry situation. On the other hand, we wouldn't be doing what we're doing here if it weren't for them. Other questions? Yeah, way in the back. Well, I come and talk at your company for a very large fee. See, it's a free market institution, and I love the marketplace for me. All things are possible. All things are possible. Yeah. Sorry.
When you talk about James Washington, like that, it's not very clear that the CEO or leader who is actually convinced to write out the change and obviously, for example, is there any way for must be to see you take that kind of view or what James absolutely for relatively over time.
Well, I think if you want institutional change with some speed, almost by definition, it's got to come from the top. The good news, however, is, or the tough news, the tough message, is I am also completely unsympathetic with the person running a 700-person factory in a 70,000-person company who tells me that she or he can't do anything. The truth of the matter is that since the beginning of my research, I have seen fabulous factories, fabulous sales branches, fabulous accounting departments, fabulous divisions within the most amazingly stodgy bureaucratic companies that you can imagine. The bad news is that if you cause a revolution in factory A in a 17-factory company, the odds of it automatically diffusing to the other 16 factories or division are low or approximately none. But it can be done. Look. My bias is very strong. There is no excuse for not taking every job as an opportunity, as an exciting opportunity to screw around and try stuff, you know? I mean, I'm not as young as I used to be, and as I get older, sometimes really elderly people like myself start, you know, you have these dreams and you can imagine things like your tombstone. And one night I remember I woke up and I saw my epitaph on the tombstone. And it said, and whenever I see this, it's happened a couple times since, I wake up with a case of the chills and the sweats. And it says, Thomas J. Peters, fortunately the last number's not filled in. It's Thomas J. Peters, he made budget. I mean, can you imagine sort of retiring at the age of 63 from a company and the chairman comes down to shake your hands and says, congratulations, for 42 consecutive years, you made budget. I mean, to me, that is the analog to brain dead. So my hypothesis, you know, as I've watched companies over the years, and I started out in the public sector, that is to say the United States Navy, I have seen obstreperous corporals and obstreperous sergeants and obstreperous ensigns and obstreperous lieutenants in the most bureaucratic places in the world who just pretend that the hierarchy of the United States Navy didn't really exist and the whole Navy was a place for them to screw around and play with for the next 2 years. That's the way I treated it. I had a ball in the Navy. I used to get chewed out by my commanding officer every time. He'd come to me and say, why the hell are you the only guy in this battalion who doesn't salute me? I says, nothing personal. It's hard to believe. I've given these speeches sometimes, and somebody come to me afterwards, you know, say, well, Thomas really great, it's the fabulous stuff. My boss, if only my boss, you know, it's always if only my boss. I've had that line come from nursing supervisors in hospitals, and I have had that line come from 55-year-old executive vice presidents in multi-billion-dollar companies who say to me, Tom, this stuff is really great, but I can't do it. It's a 55-year-old EVP pulling down $250,000 a year. And he says, this stuff about, you know, empowering people is really good. I can't do it. Hey, look, tough, you know? What do you want me to do? And so I had no patience with that at all. One last question.
I just wanted to insert the simultaneous need that I see to get the bureaucratic regulators out of our way. And I had a highly innovative teleshopping company, which, among other things, introduced computer grocery shopping. We invariably had a bureaucrat come in and say, you can't do what you're doing because the Meat Inspection Act of 1925 doesn't provide for computerized grocery shopping, and stopping us. And I see that over and over again.
Yeah, I think there is no issue about that. As the satellites get mounted more rapidly on the backs of elephants, the requirement, the crucial, the essential central requirement for government to keep up with the pace of change going on in the private sector is really very clearly there. The odds of it happening, unfortunately, are approximately zero. The only good news is that even with the deregulation that we're seeing in the developing countries, the truth of the matter is amongst the developed wealthy countries, we still do relatively well on the relatively less screwed up scale. That is to say, we're sort of only like 97 out of 100 on awful relative to on that particular scale. But, you know, there's no question about that being the case. I look at it, as I said, as a Southerner, and we're losing a hell of a lot of business in the Valley to Texas, to Portland, to various other places in large measure because of the inability of businesses to be able to do things that even if you are a radical environmentalist or whatever, you've got to believe are hardly insane. But it's right on the money. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Tom. There's not much more that I can say that he has not only exuberated us with. Those of you who are new again to the Institute, we welcome you to future Institute events. Our next luncheon will be on July 27th with Charles Murray, the author of Losing Ground and In Pursuit. Please, those of you who have not been acquainted with Tom's books, pick up a copy on your way out. I'm sure you'd be delighted to autograph it. And thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to seeing you again sometime soon.